This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we continue our drumbeat reporting from the streets of Tegucigalpa and inside the Brazilian embassy, where a military coup standoff continues in Honduras. Also, author and journalist Max Blumenthal dissects the inner workings of the religious right wing in his new book, Republican Gomorrah, and Jimbo Simmons of the American Indian Movement talks about the ongoing fight for indigenous rights in North America. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A little later on in this broadcast, we will go live to the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa. But first, must tell you that the very bad situation in Honduras will now and is now growing worse by the hour. The illegal military regime, headed by Micheletti and Ramon Vasquez, have announced, of course, their suspending all constitutional civil liberties for 45 days. So we're going to continue our reporting, and it begins with Andres, who we spoke with just a couple of hours ago inside the embassy. Listen to this.
This is Andres Thomas Contreras with Democracy Now! En Español and close collaboration with Flashpoints, KPFA. Here at the Embassy of Brazil in Tegucigalpa, the last 24 hours have been very intense. The coup regime has declared a state of emergency, suspending constitutional guarantees that permit people to freely associate, meet together, transport any transportation that is not authorized. There's been closures of television and radio stations, and the threat of an invasion of the embassy itself, where President Manuel Zelaya is, has been for the last week, is very imminent. The regime has said, has communicated to Brazil that Brazil must define the status of Manuel Zelaya at the embassy within 10 days, or else the embassy will lose its diplomatic immunity and become any old building in the capital where the police and military could raid if they choose so. This, along with what happened yesterday to the OAS members, there were functionaries of the government who arrived at the Tonkontin Airport in Tegucigalpa a few days ahead of the arrival of foreign ministers from countries that are part of the OAS. These government officials were turned back at the airport. They were deported. They included U.S. official and other countries that this regime does not consider friendly, and so they shipped them out of the country. This is after they had said that they would be welcome, and then not, and then again, yes, welcome, and then they were deported. So, again, this de facto regime continues to act in a very arbitrary way and continues to change its positions with regard to whether this process can move forward to some kind of a resolution with the international community facilitating it.
And Andres, is the president taking any special precautions since the added crackdown by the government and the buildup around the embassy? Is there any sense coming from outside of the country that there needs to be more protection?
The statements from the international community have insisted that this embassy be protected. Hillary Clinton has said that. In terms of any measures taken here, we can take extra precaution in terms of being alert about any possible raid. However, we are unarmed here and cannot defend ourselves very much against soldiers, that some of whom have been reported to be carrying bazookas lately. So the militarization of this place continues to be very, very intense, and there's really no way that we could defend if they chose to raid and to arrest us all.
We spoke to Dr. Juan Alamanderas, and he was not able to get into the embassy to treat patients a couple of days ago. I'm wondering, what is the physical situation inside the embassy? Are people okay generally? What's going on there at that level?
Generally, people are okay. There is a doctor here now who's here 24 hours. We just had another medical visit as well. In fact, I'm right here very nearby this medical person who I think did come in the name of the Red Cross, or at least in the name of the United Nations. So medicines have been allowed to come in. Food and water is also not a problem any longer, and electricity and water has also flowed in. So those problems have been resolved, but the arbitrary nature of attacks on the embassy by cutting off phone communications and cutting us off from information from the outside world in the country, especially the closure of Radio Globo and the closure of Channel 36, is a very severe blow to us here in the embassy, but also to the entire country. Those two media were the ones who have been principally informing the public about any effort of the people to try to pressure the coup regime to accept the democratically elected president as Mr. Zelaya as the president of Honduras.
Is there a sense that some of the key players in this, like the United States, are actually really risking a great deal in not taking stronger action, given the current intensification of an already lethal situation?
It seems like the U.S. still has a lot of arrows in its quiver that it is not using. It has never done anything with regard to trade sanctions against the coup regime. This country trades with the U.S., and it represents about 70 to 75% of all of its trade. If the U.S. even whispered the possibility of what it has been doing to Cuba for decades, this regime would fall very, very quickly, because the business elite would not stand that, and they would rise up as well against those who are in power. In terms of other measures, the U.S. Continues to have military connections to the Honduran military through the training that takes place at the School of the Americas, now known as WINSEC, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And the U.S. needs to demand that the international community at the OAS and at the United Nations issue an ultimatum to the coup regime with a very specific timeline. This would really indicate a change in terms of the international community's response to the crisis, because so far, really, all that has happened from the international community are very, very helpful statements, but really, at the end of the day, those statements are just words compared to the very intense actions that are being taken by the coup regime here, and those actions end up being very, resulting in severe repression against the Honduran people.
And I just finally, Andres, I want to ask you, while we have this clear line to the embassy where you are now in Tegucigalpa, with the shutting down of all press that is in any way considered opposition or anti-coup, is there now an added concern that the information, and this is how it seems in the United States, the information coming out to the rest of the world based on a real lack of an open flow of information. There's these two political parties fighting, and the some of the poorest people in the world are suffering in the middle because they can't sit down.
That's very, very true. You know, those who end up really being the losers in practically all wars are always those who are powerless and those who are poor. And that is very much the case here. The poor are forcibly economically conscripted into the army, and then they are trained to be repressive agents of the coup regime. And then they end up beating primarily the poor. So that happens at the military level, but also at the economic level. goes again, who represent the masses in the country here, are the ones who are really, really paying the price because of the isolation of Honduras by the international community. Economically, there has been trade sanctions issued by El Salvador and by Nicaragua. Those are big trading partners. And if those sanctions would be intensified by the U.S., then there would be real pressure against the elite because it would be so widespread. But again, it is those who are poor who end up suffering as a result of the rich and the powerful wanting to stay in power. This is Andres Thomas Conteris reporting for Democracy Now! In Español and also for Flashpoints KPSA, reporting from the Brazilian Embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras.
This is Tim Russo in the outskirts of Tegucigalpa. We're following the funeral procession of Wendy Elizabeth Avila, who was killed over the weekend, who died over the weekend after being subjected to the police repression last Tuesday in front of the Brazilian embassy, where her asthmatic condition came to the excessive amount of tear gas that were used to break up and to disperse thousands that had gathered at the Brazilian embassy to greet the arrival of Manuel Zelaya. We're following her funeral procession from Stevie's Union headquarters to a cemetery about 15 kilometers on the outskirts of Tegucigalpa, where you may remember that Roger Vallejo, the first teacher that was killed a little over a month ago here in Tegucigalpa in another demonstration, was also buried. This will be the second person from the movement that's been buried in this particular cemetery on the outskirts of town. And we're following the motorcycle brigade that Wendy had participated in as part of security measures. She had ridden on the back of a Kawasaki motorcycle with her boyfriend carrying the Honduran banner during much of the last 3 months of resistance in the streets. She was a figure that we've seen a lot almost every day in those marches carrying that flag. So that motorcycle brigade is leading the procession with her coffin and her boyfriend driving the vehicle behind them. We'll be following this and accompanying the family and friends, motorcycle brigade, members of the popular resistance as they mourn Wendy's death. She was 24. She was a student in the university here in Tegucigalpa, and folks were chanting just moments ago, "Who killed Wendy?" And people responded, "The golpistas, the coup leaders did." And that chant was being repeated and repeated. So we've been hearing that, and we're just going to follow this and see how things continue to develop here in Tegucigalpa.
Well, Tim, let me jump in here. Now, this is a funeral taking place on a day in which the coup government has extended its powers, shut down all opposition media, or attempted to do that, and threatened all protesters with arrest. Is this a funeral march for this resistance activist meeting with any resistance?
At the moment, it's not meeting with any resistance. Actually, what we are seeing is rather a very watchful accompaniment by the Cobra Special Forces of the National Police that are mobilizing troop carriers behind the procession, following the procession from the Virginia headquarters to the cemetery. There's the water tank that was threatening the demonstrators earlier in the morning is also following that vehicle, that procession. We'll see if it comes all the way up to the cemetery or not. But the special forces are following the march. But they had negotiated, the demonstrators and the folks involved with organizing the funeral procession, safe passage, that they were coming to mourn the loss of Wendy Avila and that they were not going to be provoking any trouble, to get through the nonviolent funeral procession to mourn her death.
All right, Tim Russo, we're going to let you follow that funeral procession. I guess it's important to note, though, before we say goodbye, that the death of this young woman, this student, one of the leaders of the resistance, it's not a surprise that it's a young woman, because women are playing a significant role in this resistance, aren't they?
They are indeed. I would say that the women are the majority of people that are in in the resistance movement on many different levels, whether that's the street vendors organization that's gotten together almost all, entirely women, to organize a sector of society that was not organized prior to the coup here. It's really been politicized. The teachers, many of the teachers are the women, many of the directors of the schools that have been targeted by pro-Micheletti supporters and fathers and mothers and families are also directors of those schools where the teachers have been on strike for the last month and now for the last days over things that I have been back in the country. So their presence is huge, and it is no surprise that it was the latest death was the first woman to die since the conflict.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints. We continue our coverage of the coup in Honduras. That's Tim Russo. Tim, we're going to join you later for the live broadcast, and we're going to hear more about what happened as you follow this procession. Thanks for being with us. Be careful.
Okay, we'll keep you up to date. Thanks, Dennis.
And we are back live. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And Andres and Tim have joined us back live again. Let me just check in with you, Andres. You're inside the Brazilian embassy. Everything status quo?
Yes. Dennis, I think you're greeting me. It's kind of going in and out a little.
Yes, please continue.
It's great to be back on Flashpoints. I'm glad that Tim has given an update. Here at the embassy, the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, the tents are both jubilant in terms of ongoing resistance, this being the third month since the coup was plagued upon the Honduran people. And at the same time, serious, very, very grave concern around the decree by the dictator Micheletti and of course, the expulsion of the OAS diplomats who came to prepare the trip later in the week for foreign ministers, but also the reaction of the United States in the OAS debate today. The ambassador there, or the I guess he's the deputy official in front of the OAS by the United States, called the return of President Zelaya to his country as being foolish. And this is a huge blow, and it's a total turnaround. I mean, the United States now seems to be acting like the Micheletti pathological regime, which, for example, said that, yes, the OAS representatives could land in Honduras. Then they said no. Then they said yes again, and then they kicked them out of the country. So now, is Hillary's words a week ago what the Obama policy is in terms of welcoming President Zelaya back to his country, or is the policy now that it was a foolish decision? And these words come when the most repressive decree is spoken by this dictatorship. And how is it that the United States has not at all condemned human rights violations by this de facto regime? Congressman Grijalva of Arizona wrote on Friday a very strong, very well-documented letter regarding human rights atrocities committed by the...
Andres, can you move your body? We're losing you on the... We just lost Andres. Eric, let's see if we can get Andres back. I'm going to bring Tim into the conversation. Tim Russo, we just lost Andres, but we're talking about the United States once again essentially siding with the coup. Last we left you were at a funeral procession. Has this reaction by the U.S. in terms of really an attack on President Zelaya been reverberating at the grassroots level?
No, on the grassroots level, at the funeral itself, we didn't hear any mention of the information that Andres was reporting about the United States position, new position, or flipped position in front of the Organization of American States.
what actually was reverberating more on the ground this afternoon and through the procession up to the funeral and even during the funeral was we were hearing murmurs and small statements come from Porfirio Lobos, the presidential candidate for the National Action Party, for the PAN. And he was saying earlier today that his party will not support the presidential decree that was decreed yesterday. So this was huge information here. We've been trying to follow that up and confirm that the Congress was supposed to be meeting about that this morning and this afternoon. This morning, we don't believe that they got into that conversation. They took a midday recess and were to be back into the Congress touching upon the theme of the presidential decree as of 2 o'clock this afternoon. We didn't get a confirmation if that discussion did take place or not, but we were hearing also that the UVE, the Democratic Unification Party, was thinking about going back into the congressional debate for the first time since the coup. The UVE had stepped out of Congress and removed itself from Congress immediately after June 28th coup, and they were going to go back today in order to enter into this debate and support the position that the decree could not be ratified by the Congress, essentially calling it an illegal decree outside of the legal powers of any president and most certainly outside of the power of a de facto president. So we're trying to follow up on that to find out for sure what and how Porfirio Lobos, a presidential candidate for the National Action Party, expressed his worries about the presidential decree and what that might mean also for the electoral process, which the de facto regime and the presidential candidates, except for Cesar Ham and Carlos Aguirre, the independent and the UVE candidate, are saying will be the only way to find a local national solution to the conflict in Honduras through the electoral process. So we'll see what comes out of that discussion today in the Congress.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Tim Russo on the ground in Tegucigalpa. We're talking about an expanded crackdown now by the coup government and the United States. Talk about reckless action. If the U.S. We should also say that we're trying now to get Andres back on the phone. He is inside the Brazilian embassy where President Zelaya is holding out. For the U.S. to say that Zelaya, the duly constituted president, returning to his country is reckless and irresponsible opens the door for the coup government to attack the embassy. Andres, you're back with us, yes?
I am just glad to be back, and these cutouts of cell phone communication are also part of the strategy of the coup regime against those of us here in the embassy.
Well, we're glad to get you back, and I want to follow up what you were saying. If the U.S. is calling Zelaya's courageous return to the country irresponsible, they're opening the door for the coup government to attack.
They really are, Dennis, and I don't know if you heard me say, referred to the letter from Congressman Grijalva.
Give us that again, please. Andres? You see, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Andres Canteres, who is a correspondent for Democracy Now! In Espanol and has been doing wonderful special correspondent work for Flashpoints and the entire Pacifica network. He's inside the Brazilian consulate. We're going to keep trying to keep him on. It's why I recorded him earlier when we had a good line, because the interference from the coup government now has been intensified in the last 24 hours. They have increased their crackdown, and that increase now includes the suspension of all civil liberties for the next 45 days, according to this new decree by Micheletti and General Ramon Vasquez. They are the leaders of the coup government, and I think we do have Andres back. Andres, tell us what the concern is now, because obviously the U.S. has opened up the door for an attack.
The concern is that Obama was sent a letter by Congressman Grijalva, which completely documented human rights atrocities in this country. And the U.S. administration has never, ever condemned human rights atrocities since the coup regime took power. And the letter from Grijalva really clearly shows that over and over how death and disappearance and violations documented by the most respected human rights folks. And for the U.S., on this day, on this Monday, when this decree, which basically describes this country as a dictatorship, goes into effect, it chooses to criticize President Obama in complete contrast to the welcome words that Secretary Hillary Clinton gave upon President Obama's return to the country. What is the message that's really going out? It really has to do with the U.S. not at all supporting the fact that Mel Zelaya is back here. They have never condemned any of the human rights atrocities, and it shows that means the U.S. population has to rise up and pressure the U.S. Administration in order to really, really change its policy. This is consistent with the U.S. ongoing training of Honduran soldiers at the School of the Americas. It's consistent with the fact that the U.S. has not even defined that a military coup has taken place in Honduras, which would if there was a legal decision on that definition, then it would have to comply with Section 7008 of the Foreign Assistance Act and completely cut off many, many more millions of dollars than it has. It's never even considered a trade embargo against the coup regime like has been practiced for decades against Cuba. So all of these things show the complete hypocrisy of U.S. policy with regard to standing up for human rights in Central America, in the world, and particularly not doing so here in Honduras.
Andres Thomas Canteres talking to us from inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, where the illegal coup is in its third month. Let's remember that this coup began with soldiers in masks showing up at the presidential palace and taking the president in his pajamas out of the country. This is what the United States refuses to call a coup.
Every nick and now, even if we don't fight, bodies hit the ground. Spit the sound of a million fists finna pound. I'm in the crowd till this whole thing switch round. Brains on temporary disconnect. I shoot my mouth off, I can't find my pistol yet. You can call this music disrespect, cause it'll slap you in your face at your local discotheque. Mr. Green with your missiles and rockets. My paycheck burns a hole in your pocket. You told the judge, put my name on the docket. Meeting in the break room, here's where we plotted. Let's fight, let's smash, let's win. We gon' fight, we gon' smash, let's in. Let's fight, let's smash, let's win. Just like getting up in the club with a fake ID. If it don't work, we gon' do it again. Your honor, man, please, the coach. Swear me in on a book full of two-by quotes. After what I say, you might noose my throat. Reporter, please, scribble down a few hot notes. Allow me to be the first to throw dirt on the graves. Excuse me, I never learned to behave. My great-great-granny was a Carolina slave. She whispers in my ear, saying spark the blaze. Somewhere on the east side, I steal and rob. A whole generation gotta make a job. And the light bill still ain't resolved. See the hungry mouth pulse and thrive. If you got a blacklist, I wanna be on it. If we gonna attack this, then we need to run it.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of the struggle by indigenous peoples of this land, the Native American community, to take back their sacred sites. And there have been marches all over this country and battles that continue here on the West Coast in the Bay Area in California. There's a battle unfolding now. There's a fight for Indian lands. And joining us to talk about that is Jimbo Simmons. He is a spokesperson for the American Indian Movement National. Jimbo, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Yes, Dennis, thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us about the walk. What's going on?
Yes, well, you know, as you remember, a lot of struggles going on across this land. And just recently, last year, we had the longest walk, which was about sacred sites, you know, the violations that's continue on across this country and respect towards Native people's sacred areas. So, and there's just one of those sites here in the Bay Area, particularly up a little bit in the what they call Vallejo area, which is the Glen Cove Shell Mound. I think it's called the Korean Shell Mound site, which is about 3,500, 4,000 years old, is what archaeologists say. But the city of Vallejo is getting ready to develop it, into a bigger park and an area there. And the community there, some of the local Native people and other groups within the Bay Area have been fighting that development. And one of the local groups there, the Intertribal Vallejo Council, is in the forefront of that struggle, led by Wounded Knee and others of that area. So they had a walk yesterday. It was in honor of our ancestors, walking with our ancestors and praying for our ancestors. And it was a very good experience, as all Native walks are, and particularly this walk when we're talking about protection of sacred sites. We started out with a ceremony, and then they walked over to the, I guess it'd be the Glen or Vallejo Utilities Building or some group there that, you know, that are promoting this development. And there they issued a letter to the Utilities Department District there, and, you know, Recreation Department, and issued their ultimatum to stop the development. So anyway, and then they continued on to the Glen Cove Shell Mound site, again, where they closed it off with some ceremonies and some speaking. But I just wanted to remind folks again that, you know, this is an ongoing problem, particularly here in the Bay Area, particularly now when we see, the Columbus Day, International Day of Solidarity activities unfolding here in the next couple of months, including the Alcatraz Island events that are going to be taking place. And of course, we're going to be hearing more of these issues, and particularly the Glen Cove site itself. And people want to get involved with that, they can go to the Intertribal Vallejo Council and get involved with that. But I think it was very important to be there.
Let me jump in and ask you, in terms of it being very important, why is this particular struggle, this struggle for these sacred sites, beyond the actual meaning of the sites, what is the symbolism here, and why is this the place where Native peoples are drawing that line?
Well, in many of the Native people stories in regards to the creation stories, as our people have evolved, and these stories are very important to these areas, what we call sacred areas. Some people will refer to them as sacred sites, but I think we're thinking of much more bigger than that. Matter of fact, we could also say that Mother Earth is a very sacred area, but for our Native areas, you know, there are very sacredness areas, and the Shell Mound is one of those areas where, you know, when people are moved on and villages are moved and they've relieved their remains there or burials there, or and it holds some sacredness to, you know, a lot of the issues that many of our people are, you know, not the issues, but the traditions and the cultures and the ways that we are carrying on today. And these areas are integral part of that understanding of who we are as Native people, as indigenous peoples, as the original peoples of this land. So it connects to actually who we are as a people, and different nations, different tribes has their own stories. And so each area is, I guess you could say, is sacred. But I think we as Native indigenous peoples of these lands, you know, we respect that. As a matter of fact, just as we would respect, you know, churches and other institutions or religious ways. But today, unfortunately, it's Indian people's ways that are still being disrespected and developed. And, you know, and I don't know, one of the things that we can always refer to is in 1978, the passage of the Indian Religious Freedom Act, which was supposed to help Native people protect more of their religion and their sacred areas and sacredness. Unfortunately, we're still involved in that today. And so, you know, I kind of question about the sincerity of laws in regards to respecting who we are as Native people.
All right. Jimbo Simmons of the American Indian Movement, a spokesperson, talking about one more struggle to retain sacred areas where Native peoples were and were taken violently from their land in this genocide, which continues to this day. Jimbo Simmons, appreciate the important information. Obviously, we're going to stay right on it.
And you know, just to clear, it's an Ohlone site. I should also refer to that, as which is one of the local tribes in the area. And of course, you know, I guess you would know that the Emeryville area is a shale mound too. So just
right.
To point that out.
Just to point out that all of it is stolen land. When I think about this and I think about growing up, I grew up on the East Coast on a place called Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Long Island Railroad, and every stop on the Long Island Railroad is probably an Indian sacred ground. And stolen. The names are Indian tribes. And I never knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
So, we're still carrying on these issues, you know, and Glen Cove is one of them.
All right, well, I thank you for being with us, and
right.
We'll talk soon.
Well, thank you, Dennis. All right.
Take care now.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The hysterical, fabricated, right-wing-led movement against public option health care in this country continues to grow. The religious right, fired up by Fox News fanatics Glenn Beck and others, have become a dangerous force, undermining any attempt at real health care reform. But how did this movement begin? How is it pieced together? And what makes it such an authoritarian and unwavering sectarian agenda in this country? Meticulously researched and peppered with a healthy dose of snark to highlight a histrionic circus of the absurd, the brand new book Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, peels back the layers of the current right wing's power structure to reveal what author Max Blumenthal describes as a, quote, political, social, and religious movement defined from an escape from freedom. Joining us to talk about his new book, Republican Gomorrah, is Max Blumenthal. Blumenthal is an award-winning investigative reporter. He's a writing fellow at the Nation Institute and is the senior writer for The Daily Beast. Max, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Great to be back.
So let's begin by having you assess and break down what we're seeing in terms of this very troubling and very aggressive right-wing movement that's targeting healthcare reform policy. In fact, today in Congress, there is a very significant vote. Someone recently said that America is the only country in the world where people protest against health care. Who's behind this, and how has this movement picked up so much steam? And maybe dissect what went on today.
Well, I mean, what went on today was really Max Baucus in action, who's a Democrat, who's a tool of the insurance industry. And I haven't been following it as closely as I normally would since I've been on this punishing book tour. But, I mean, I understand that Baucus's former chief of staff, Jim Messina, is the assistant chief of staff now to Barack Obama. He's Rahm Emanuel's mini-me. And many of the people who've come through Baucus's office have gone straight into Cigna and other healthcare industry giants. It's sort of a revolving door. And so, you know, he has a deep-seated hostility to any government option. At the same time, we're seeing him receive some support for this from the right. He's been negotiating this bill with Chuck Grassley, who's the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee. And Grassley has echoed Sarah Palin, who is echoing the LaRouche crazies, on the notion that Barack Obama would re-implement Hitler's T4 program to euthanize the elderly and severely disabled through his healthcare program. This is, you know, Charles Grassley, who's in charge of negotiating for the Republicans. So we've seen a totally intransigent Republican Party in the throes, in the thrall of the Christian right. But the American public is on the other side. The American public may not identify as progressive. They may think that liberal is a dirty word. But the most recent New York Times CBS poll shows 60% favor a public option. 63% are opposed to a bill, exactly the sort of bill that Baucus has proposed, which would be the largest transfer of wealth in American history to private corporations, which has mandates but no public option. So they want a progressive option. They're on the side of the progressive Democrats in the Congress. But Barack Obama's wavering, not showing a lot of leadership. And what the right has done is just cause a lot of chaos, and it goes far beyond health care. The goal is to not only delegitimize Barack Obama, but to delegitimize the federal government as a mechanism that can help people's lives. And it goes to sort of the central idea of my book, that the right exploits personal crisis for political gain, and that behind the politics of resentment is this culture of personal crisis. And so many crises in middle America, especially in the red states, stem from healthcare costs. And so they fear that the government could somehow ameliorate these crises instead of the church and their crisis industry.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. He's written a brand new book called Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Let's dive into your book. The New Yorker said that Republican Gomorrah is an irresistible combination of anthropology and psychopathology that exerts the queasy fascination of, let's face it, something very like pornography. And I guess this is very much...
That was actually a blurb. But...
A blurb, right. And I guess this is very much an anthropological investigation into a movement that here... for listeners to Pacifica Radio, we don't know much about in terms of the inner workings. Tell us about your intent in researching this movement and some of your revelations.
Well, there are a lot of revelations in this book, and including revelations about those who believe literally in the Book of Revelations. I have covered the radical right for 6 years, I guess, since my journalistic career began, with a few forays into some other topics that aren't as that are maybe even more controversial that we can get into later in the broadcast. But this book was an attempt to package my reporting, my analysis, my research into one vehicle, but to go beyond who the players in the movement are and what they do. I think that's well known, and any reporter from the New York Times can tell you about that. But because I've had this intimate contact with followers and the leaders of the movement that I think controls the Republican Party, I wanted to explain why they do what they do and what's behind the histrionics, what's behind the resentment, what's behind the Hitler posters on the National Mall on 9/12. And I think I'm able to offer a pretty unique analysis that rings true. When I've been touring around the country, I meet a lot of people who come out of this environment who tell me that that I've hit the nail on the head, that it's not about religion. It's about emotion and psychology, and it's about a particular form of psychology that manipulates people who are predisposed to authoritarian structures. It's why the central figure in my book, James Dobson, is not a religious figure, although he leads a purportedly religious movement. He has no theological credentials, although reporters wrongly refer to him as Reverend Dobson. He's actually Dr. Dobson. He's a child psychologist, and he understands, as I do, that there is this culture of personal crisis out there that can easily be converted into an authoritarian movement, and has been.
And Dobson is responsible for preening people like Tom DeLay and who else?
Ted Bundy
and Newt Gingrich into becoming these leaders or visionaries, luminaries of the religious right wing. Maybe not Ted Bundy, but...
Ted Bundy was a poster child for the religious right helped put Vault Dobson onto the national stage. But let's start with Tom DeLay, since he was on TV last night as Two-Step Tommy.
Yeah, I think that was the nadir of Western civilization right there, right? Like
the Ralph Nader?
Nadir, right. That was the lowest point I think we've hit.
I think Nader would be insulted. I think he's a much better dancer than that. Tom DeLay, yeah, he looked kind of like on this TV show, like a disco kind of pervert, wife swapper, stag film kind of Bob Crane character. And actually, that's who he was when he was in Texas as a state legislator taking on the EPA because he was an exterminator. And he had no religion. He had no values. He was just obsessed with taking on the federal government so he could expand his business, killing cockroaches. And when he entered, and his nickname was Hot Tub Tommy because he was hanging out in hot tubs with women other than his wife. He lived in a place they nicknamed Macho Manor in Austin with a bunch of other Republicans where they'd have these all-night parties and have rowdy sex and, you know, kind of stuff you imagine in, you know, one of James Dobson's nightmares. But when DeLay came to the Congress, he was buttonholed by this backbencher evangelical conservative named Frank Wilf in the Capitol basement. And he said, come in this room. I want to show you a movie. And DeLay refused, but he kept pushing him. And he finally got him to see this movie by James Dobson, Where's Dad?, where Dobson talks about, you know, how fathers who are derelict need to spend more time with their children, sort of a basic message. And he sings The Cat's in the Cradle into the camera. And DeLay was deeply affected by this. DeLay had had an alcoholic father who viciously abused him. Dobson himself was abused as a child, had the same proclivities and sensibility as Tom DeLay. And they related to each other. And DeLay broke down in tears when he saw this and became, soon after, a born-again evangelical, a close ally of Dobson. And he transformed from Hot Tub Tommy into the Hammer. And Dobson sicked DeLay on Newt Gingrich. You know, as conservative as Newt Gingrich was, he wasn't conservative enough for Dobson. His Contract for America contained no mention of the so-called gay agenda or abortion. And he was too willing to compromise with Bill Clinton because Gingrich was purely Machiavellian. He had no, he didn't have this Manichaean worldview that DeLay had. He himself was having an affair with a woman while he was leading impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, with a woman 20 years his junior who was on the congressional payroll. And as soon as he left his second wife for her. So this was not a figure that the Christian right was going to like. And he would melt when he would meet privately with Bill Clinton because he privately admired Clinton. So they hated him. DeLay came and replaced him after several coup attempts, and they finally had a vote of no confidence forcing Gingrich to resign. And DeLay wound up creating this, you know, attempting to create the one-party Republican state that Dobson dreamed of, that Karl Rove dreamed of, and that eventually would bring George W. Bush into power with the Christian right grassroots shock troops as its, you know, as its base. But it also produced the most corrupt Congress in history and wound up driving the Republicans into this spiraling crisis as people who had come from a culture of personal crisis projected their personal crises into the public sphere, into the political arena, like DeLay.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, how these little cadres of born-again evangelicals in positions of power influence an entire belt of people throughout this country who then show up at the steps of the Capitol a few weeks ago with these posters of Obama as Hitler.
Well, I was there on the National Mall on 9/12, and I shot a video, which you can see. I think it's still up on my site, and you can just search YouTube for the unauthorized 9/12 Teabagger Tour. The working title of the documentary is Lifestyles of the White and Highly Suggestible, because there are so many people down there I spoke to didn't have health care, who were content to rally against having health care. They didn't want health care. They thought the government, if the government provided them health care, that's one step towards totalitarianism. And they believed all these messages they were getting from Glenn Beck, who is the top-rated Fox News host. So Glenn Beck is sort of one of the figures who implants these messages in the minds of people who are who are predisposed to an authoritarian mindset. But Dobson and his top lobbyist, Tony Perkins, in Washington have also been involved in this. And I think the press has overlooked their role in convincing the Christian right shock troops that Dobson's healthcare plan is going to force taxpayers to fund abortion. And so that's what really motivated them to come out onto the National Mall. We saw so many different elements, this amorphous movement that just happened to be all white, come out onto the National Mall. And behind it all was Dick Armey, the former Republican House Majority Leader, who is now a corporate lobbyist, who has a front group called Freedom Works, which refuses to disclose its corporate donors, but is funded by the healthcare industry and so many other corporations, which would be severely harmed by a policy as tame and centrist as the public option. And so they've used all these people who could very well benefit from healthcare reform as their shock troops, shepherding them out there with these messages of resentment and these warnings that their country is turning into a totalitarian fascist republic. And they've used them against themselves. Where it goes is unclear. But if you look at any poll on how many Americans believe in these wild conspiracy theories that they're introducing, it's clear that these theories are only influencing, that they've created an echo chamber. These theories are only influencing the far right. Only about 35% of Americans believe in death panels. Only about, and the high, I think the number's in the high 30s about whether Obama's healthcare plan will provide free healthcare to undocumented immigrants. So the main, you know, American mainstream is not going along with the teabagger movement, but what they're doing in the process, Focus on the Family, Freedom Works, all these organizations, is by ramping up resentment, they're raising a lot of money and they're trying to take out the 35 Democratic blue dogs in heavily Republican districts, and a lot of teabaggers are in these districts because they're in the South. A lot of their shock troops are there. So it's a calculated political plan. I think it's sort of clever, but the effort is not to influence the American public, which is rejecting this. And at the same time, they are inadvertently damaging the Republican brand so that the party is like totally reduced to its power base in the Deep South. And the approval rating of congressional Republicans in the Northeast is 7%.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. He's the author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And we only have a few minutes left, and we could talk for hours about this. I have tons of questions. But I think in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have, let's talk about the pervasive role of born-again Christianity in the movement. You write that, quote, members of the movement believe they are subject to a different set of laws than outsiders, no matter how horrendous their sins have been. Sinners can be forgiven time and time again by simply absolving themselves through being born again and by absorbing the sadomasochistic culture of the Christian right. And this is an interesting point you make, that there's a symbiotic and intrinsic connection between born-again Christianity and sadomasochism as an ideology. Explain this relationship a little bit here.
Well, Eric Fromm, the psychologist who inspired a lot of, much of my analysis, I came to his writings while I was covering this movement, and they really came as a revelation to me. I think he was able to articulate so many of my observations and put them together, especially in a book he wrote in 1941 called Escape from Freedom. And Fromm talks about the concept of a magic helper, that followers of the movement, those who flock to authoritarian structures, those who flee freedom in a democratic society, need a magic helper like Dobson, someone who is much more charismatic than just a political leader. It's a person who provides them with a glorious crusade and symbols that give their life meaning. And Fromm says, the reason why a person is bound to a magic helper are in principle the same that we have found at the root of sadomasochistic drives, an inability to stand alone and to fully express his own individual potentialities. Now, I'm not talking about sadomasochism as a sexual kink, nor was Fromm, although some who are politically sadomasochistic, like Ted Haggard, did participate in real sadomasochism. It means this symbiosis between sadism, the drive and desire to kick down those they perceive as weaker than them, foreigners, minorities, the poor, African-American White House czars, and fused with this masochistic tendency to prostrate themselves at the feet of the magic helper, the strong leader, the George W. Bush, who expresses total certainty in all his decisions, James Dobson, the strict father archetype, or the macho Jesus from Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. And so sadomasochism is the essential I think, characteristic of the authoritarian personality that defines the movement that controls the Republican Party.
All right. In the last minute we have, you've done a ton of guerrilla-style videos exposing the hyperbole and the absurd hypocrisy of the Christian right in this country. But earlier this year, you went to Israel-Palestine to document very similar and very troubling reality there. What surprised you the most about similarities or differences between the right-wing movement here and the Zionist right-wing movement there?
I haven't really thought of a way to compare and contrast these two, although there is a connection through the Christian Zionist movement. But with Israel, we see a country that's gone possibly irrevocably to the right and never will return, a country that's going down an authoritarian path. We see it with the rise of Avigdor Lieberman. We see it with 95% support for the Gaza assault. And I wanted to go there and spend most of my time there, although I spent a week on the West Bank, to understand what happened in Gaza, to understand what's happening in the West Bank. I thought I would have to probe the mentality of average Israelis. And what I found was slightly more shocking than what I expected. I, you know, in my videos, was able to document this inviolability and sense of entitlement and inveterate and constantly deepening racism that's permeating every element of Israeli society. You know, I did this video from Jerusalem that was, you know, attacked as the drunk Jews video because I interviewed people in bars, including American Jews who were fantasizing about assassinating Obama, throwing the N-word around like Valley girls use the word like, and saying things about Arabs that you would expect to hear from Israeli settlers. But these were the, you know, children of upscale suburban Jewish elites in the United States and Israelis. And I found the same thing when I went to Tel Aviv, to Tel Aviv University, and there was a protest against a law that would have banned public observation of the Nakba, the Palestinian expulsion from Israel, being proposed by Lieberman's party. And they this small demonstration was surrounded by other students who were telling me on camera that these their fellow students should be deported from Israel and that they're all traitors, simply because they expressed some dissent. And both of those videos that I just mentioned were banned by the Huffington Post, which promotes the hell out of my videos on the Christian right, showing the same sense of inviolability, entitlement, racism, and extremism. They were banned. One of them was banned from YouTube and can't be found anywhere except on my blog, maxblumenthal.com. It's called Feeling the Hate in Jerusalem. And you can find other videos on YouTube where people are, you know, where comedians make jokes about raping women. You can see people being killed on YouTube. You can see neo-Nazis attacking immigrants on YouTube. Why was this video targeted? I think it says so much. I think the targeting of the videos says more than what's in the videos themselves.
All right. Well, we would love to have you back on the program to talk more about this. For more information on his work and reports, people can check out your website at maxblumenthal.com. Again, the book is called Republican Gomorrah. And Max, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today on Flashpoint.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.